Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa Law School's annual Buck Colbert Franklin Memorial Civil Rights Lecture was supposed to take place in February, but due to a winter weather event, it was postponed to this evening. And now, due to the COVID-19 public health emergency, that lecture will take place as a virtual lecture this evening at 6. I spoke with the lecturer, Denver University Associate Professor of Law Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, a few days before the February lecture date. Professor Garcia Hernandez specializes in something he calls crimigation law, the convergence between immigration law and criminal law. As such, he's been a critic of America's toughened approach towards immigration going back a number of years, and, of course, is an outspoken critic of the current administration's immigration and detention policy. Much has changed in U.S. immigration policy since February. Borders are largely closed, except for commerce. Legal immigration has been curtailed, and even some marriage-based green card immigrants are facing new restrictions. And even with COVID-19, nearly 40,000 immigrants are still being held in detention facilities as of early April, according to Amnesty International. Professor Garcia Hernandez will be speaking virtually again tonight at 6 o'clock on Migrating to Prison, Immigration in the Age of Mass Incarceration, the title of his latest book. To view the lecture, visit utulsa.edu, and you can find links on the events page to view the lecture. When I spoke with him in February, I asked him about his latest book, Migrating to Prison. One of the arguments you make in the book is, over most of American history, immigrants were not locked up for migrating to the United States. But today, about 400,000 people a year are incarcerated or detained. Critics use this as saying the immigration system is broken, but your view is far more cynical. You write that the system works exactly as designed. Can you describe that design?
Certainly, Rich, thanks. And as you know, I describe in the book not only the way in which people are imprisoned today because of some violation of immigration law, but also why it is that the United States adopted that policy. We haven't always locked up people. In fact, for a 25-year period in the middle of the 20th century, the United States decided to close down most of its immigration prison system, and life went on just fine without those facilities. And now that began to change in the late 70s and early 1980s, and so those decisions that were made in that period and have been building upon themselves since then are political decisions about various options that are on the table about how to enforce immigration law. And just as we at one point chose to enforce immigration law without the use of prisons, and in a later date, including up until now, chosen to enforce immigration law with prisons. So there's nothing, my driving point here is that there's nothing inevitable about the way that we do things now. We've chosen to do things the way that we do things now. Just like in the past, we chose to do things differently, and perhaps in the future, we'll choose to do things a different way yet again.
Unless you have permission to come into this country, I think you're right that this system is designed to punish, stigmatize, and marginalize.
Yeah, immigration law today tends to take the view that you can come to the United States if you have the right levels of education. That is, if you have advanced degrees, usually, or if you have the right family ties. And both of those are meaningful, to be sure. Big part of why I'm in the United States, I was born in the United States, is through family ties that allowed my mother to come to the U.S. before I was born, courtesy of my father, who she married, and he was a U.S. citizen. So I certainly don't think those options are problematic in the least, but they are off limits to many, many people. Many people who don't have family ties, or people who have family ties that require that they wait extraordinary amounts of time, decades sometimes, which is effectively not a process, right? Very few of us are interested in waiting decades before we reunite with family. The other option is, of course, educational. To get a doctorate, for example, to get a PhD, you're already among a select member of any society. And so that's off the table for many people. And yet our economic system relies very heavily on immigrant labor, including low-skilled immigrant labor. And so we do that because it's cheaper. It's cheaper to take crops and clean buildings and build houses that way. And yet we don't provide those individuals with legal authorization to come here, meaning that the incentive exists for them to come. So they do. And yet they're expected to come here without the protections of the law. And that's what makes them easily exploitable.
And that's been built into our system, not just in the last 20 years, the last 40 years, but this goes all the way back to, gosh, the 1940s, when we needed labor during World War II.
When we needed labor during World War II, we actually went out and recruited labor, Mexican labor in particular. The United States government and the Mexican government entered into a formal bilateral agreement called the Bracero Program, which is the largest guest worker program in the history of the United States. And in fact, it's the reason why my own family started turning to the United States to migrate. My grandfather, my mother's father, was raising a family in a small town in central Mexico when the Bracero program started up and started recruiting people like him who did not have much education but were able-bodied and willing to work, and recruited people like him to come to the United States exactly for the purpose of doing hard labor and farms. And so he did. Then later his oldest sons, my older uncles, followed his example. And that pattern of turning toward the United States for work remained. So that by the time my mom, who was younger, was an age to start working to help support the family, it wasn't any surprise to anyone that she also followed the same pattern. She ended up in northern Mexico, and then that's where she met my father. And as they say, the rest is history. But that was an important moment because that was a legal program that provided low-skilled Mexican laborers with permission and incentive to come to the United States. And eventually the two governments decided to end that program. But the thing is that the labor patterns were set. The economic conditions didn't change, nor did the social conditions. People met their spouses. They made friends. They bought property. They became invested in the communities that they were working in, because the thing is, migrants certainly are workers, but they're also people. And like all of us, you know, they build social connections. And so those patterns developed during the Bracero program. And once that legal permission evaporated, nothing else changed.
Now, earlier you mentioned that at one point in our history in the 20th century, we ended the policy of having immigrant detention centers. Now, they were nothing like they were today, mainly Ellis Island, Angel Island in California, in San Francisco Bay. So what was the reason for ending that in the 1950s? And again, it was a very different reason for detaining immigrants in those days than certainly today.
Well, Ellis Island, most people know the history of Ellis Island as the place that welcomed newcomers to the United States. And it certainly did do that. But the part of Ellis Island's history that most people are unfamiliar with is the part of in which it was also used as a large detention center for several decades. One woman who was detained there in the 1950s, a woman named Ellen Knopf, she was the wife of a World War II veteran. She was coming back to the United States. They were recently married, and she was coming back to the United States to join her new family, her husband's family. And she was detained there. And she, in a memoir that she wrote years later, she described the facility there as having watchtowers. She described it as having the look of a kennel. And so these are not particularly pleasant descriptions. And interestingly enough, these days we hear critics of immigration prisons describe Border Patrol holding cells along the southwestern border as perreras, which is a Spanish word essentially for dog pound or a kennel. I don't think that there's any familiarity with Ellen Knopf's memoir that results in people calling borrowing her term. It's been out of print for many, many years. But it's interesting that the facilities then, like the facilities now, bring to mind the exact same experience of being an animal that's confined in closed quarters to people who are going through these facilities that, yes, certainly are operating under very different political circumstances.
Of course, when Ellis Island finally closed, I think there was, I'm not sure if it was a Supreme Court justice or a solicitor general said, you know, this is, it's a good step for the United States. It's about time we brought this system to an end. But of course, they came back in the 1980s. And what's probably interesting to most is it's not for migration over the southern borders. Immigrant detention came back for other reasons. It came back from migration from Haiti and from Cuba.
Yeah, that's certainly right. I think you're thinking of Tom Clark, who was a justice on the Supreme Court in the 1950s, and in a decision writing on behalf of the entire court, he said, I'm going to have to paraphrase here, but something along the lines of, this is the sign of an enlightened civilization. Just like we turned toward enlightenment, if I could borrow Justice Clark's language, in the 1950s. We later did take a turn away from enlightenment, and that began under President Carter when we started seeing a large number of Haitians make their way to the United States, fleeing the economic and political turmoil that existed on the island in the late years of the Duvalier dictatorship. Following those Haitians, there were Cubans who left on the island primarily from the port of Mariel in the 1980s. Started making their way to the U.S. And the thing about the similarity that many of these individuals have is that they were poor migrants, but also dark-skinned migrants. And so the United States started turning to them as if they posed some kind of danger. Cubans in particular were depicted as being the cast-offs from Castro's prisons. They were described that way in political conversations and media conversations. Most famously, the fictionalized version of that exodus from Cuba is Al Pacino's opening scene in Scarface from the 80s. In the very beginning, it describes him as being among the folks who are leaving Cuba from Mariel, and it describes this group of people as being among the dregs of civilization, it says. And that was certainly fictional and sensationalized, right, in a Hollywood version. But it very much depicted the conversation that existed at the time. And so it makes a complete sense that when you're afraid of these people who are coming to the United States and we don't know who they are, the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration turned to locking them up. And that's put us on the path that we haven't swerved since then.
And that demonization that you write about in the Carter administration and the Reagan administration has continued to our present-day politicians over the last decade or two, regardless of party.
Regardless of party, and I think that part's supremely important. But then we fast forward a few decades, and we see that the largest population of people, of immigration prisoners in the history of the United States results under President Obama until President Trump. Right. So it's one historical record after another to me that suggests that what we're seeing is not an anomaly in President Trump, but an extension of a pattern that certainly started well before President Trump entered the White House, and that will continue well after President Trump leaves the White House, unless there's a radical change in U.S. policy.
Well, in your book, Migrating to Prison, you profiled just a few of that estimated 400,000 people a year who spend time in detention or incarcerated. And again, there's a policy of civil detention and criminal detention. Oftentimes, it's hard to tell which is which, but you profiled just a few of that estimated 400,000 in Diego Rivera Osorio, Geraldo Armijo, Edafe Okporo, and Francisco Equia. Each of them have very different stories, but they found themselves in detention for a variety of reasons. Diego has basically grown up in detention. I mean, he's 4 years. He's from a baby to 4 years old. He's spent in detention. Geraldo has served in the armed services bravely. He finds one moment, and he's in detention. Tell us a little bit about their stories.
Yeah, so Diego is a child who was born in Honduras, and when he was 1 year old, his mother Wendy decided that life there had become too dangerous for them to stay. And so, like people from all over the world have done for generations, Diego and Wendy turned to the United States for safety. And they arrived in the U.S. and they immediately asked for asylum. And with a few days of doing that, they found themselves inside this old nursing home that had been converted into a family detention center in Pennsylvania. And Diego was one when he entered there. He spent 650 nights. He turned 2 years old. He turned 3 years old. Eventually, he won his legal claim to stay in the United States, but you can never take away that 650 nights that he spent inside that facility. Jerry Armijo, Gerardo Armijo, his friends call him Jerry. And his story is particularly meaningful to me because there's so many similarities in my life and his life. We are both raised in South Texas in what is a poor, overwhelmingly Mexican community. And after high school, though, I went off to college. And Jerry went and joined the U.S. Army. So while I was being shocked by everything that was new to me in a New England Ivy League campus, Jerry was being shocked by bombs. He was tasked with patrolling in a tank, and one day his tank went over an IED. It blasted right through the bottom of the vehicle, injured his legs, and caused him to suffer some PTSD, and he got sent back to Texas to get better. Unfortunately, he didn't get the care that he needed. And so, like so many other people, he turned to self-medicating with drugs. Eventually, the police caught up with him. And as he was going through a special court designed specifically for veterans, designed to help veterans get back on their feet because of a recognition that oftentimes the trauma and the physical injuries that they go through in war result in antisocial behavior, right? It results in criminal behavior. So he was going through that court system in Texas, doing exactly as was expected of him, until one day ICE showed up, picked him up, arrested him, and sent him to one of their immigration prisons in South Texas. Because the thing is, even though Jerry, like me, was raised in South Texas, I was born in Texas, and Jerry was born about 10 miles south of where I was born. He was born south of the Rio Grande River in Mexico, meaning he was not a U.S. citizen. He's a permanent resident. He's a green card holder. He can live and work in the United States indefinitely so long as he doesn't violate immigration law. He can drive tanks on behalf of the U.S. Army. But thanks to the combination of one bomb, a shoddy healthcare system, and a few bad decisions, and all of a sudden Jerry had transformed from being a war hero to being a criminal alien. And if ICE had its way, they would not only have detained him, but they would have also deported him.
Edafe Okporo is from Nigeria, but again, found him within the detention center.
And Mr. Okporo is somebody who suffered an enormous amount of physical violence in his native Nigeria because he's gay. And so he struggled to get out of Nigeria and finally made his way to New York, where actually he continues to live to this day. But he came here asking for asylum. He eventually won that asylum claim, but while he was going through the process of requesting asylum, he was locked up. And in a memoir that he wrote, he says, "I didn't understand. I got to the United States, the land of freedom. I got to New York, the city of the Statue of Liberty, and I find myself in a jail simply because I was asking for safety." So eventually, he did win his case, and he continues to live in New York City.
Oftentimes you find people who have been here most of their life, DACA recipients. It takes just a small little episode to run afoul of immigration. You profile Celine Savadia Roman and David Rodriguez, who's like a kind of like a star Houston chef. These are people, these are people who one's a DACA recipient. Yeah. The other one has a green card. In Celine's case, she's married to an American citizen. I think a lot of people would think that puts you right on the path to citizenship.
She got locked up because she was working. I mean, the most literal way, that's the most literal explanation I can provide. She was a flight attendant, and her one of the flights that she was assigned to went to Mexico. So she was working on the flight, and before then, she had DACA. She had DACA she was a DACA beneficiary. She is. Meaning she had this promise that we're not gonna detain you, we're not gonna try to deport you. And before getting on the flight, she asked the airline manager, her supervisor, "Hey, look, I remember I have DACA. I can work. Everyone knows that I have a work permit, but I'm concerned about whether I'm gonna have problems because I'm gonna be leaving the country on this flight." And they said, no, don't worry about it. You have DACA. No, they were wrong. She got detained when she reentered the United States, going through the airport with the rest of the flight crew. her U.S. citizen husband tried to help her, and the irony is that she wasn't released until a blogger who blogged about airline rewards miles. I forget his name. It's like the points guy or something like that. Mm-hmm. Blogged about it. He has this enormous following in the very small and odd world of people like me who travel a lot and read these blogs. But that was the thing that helped her, not the fact that she has a U.S. citizen husband who was working to try to get her out. He hired a lawyer, etc. But you know, sometimes it's the publicity, the bad publicity that makes the big difference. David Rodriguez, he's sort of this celebrity chef in Houston, but he got into an altercation with two guys who were threatening him and his fiance, and he ended up getting convicted for a low-level assault crime, and that was fine. And he lived his life and kept working and for a few years without any problems until he got married. And he and his new wife decided to go on a honeymoon to Belize. And on the way back at the Miami airport is where this conviction caught up with him. It turns out this conviction doesn't result in deportation. But the officers who were making these on-the-spot determinations are required to. That's their job. You know, decided that it was a sufficiently close call that he should be detained. Unfortunately, his wife is somewhat of an amazing woman who organized legal assistance. You know, got a lawyer and helped him as he was helped David as he was going through the intensely stressful process of being detained over the holidays of all times. So not the way that anyone wants to start a marriage, but they're still married, they're still going strong, and I think what all of these examples illustrate is the fact that, you know, we're talking about a really diverse group of people when we're talking about immigration prisoners. Oftentimes people will say to me, oh, well, they don't have permission to be here in the first place. That's not true. That is some of the folks who are locked up don't have permission to be here. They cross the Arizona desert in the middle of the night. But then there's folks like Diego, right? He came here asking for asylum. Federal law is absolutely clear that anyone who is physically present in the United States can ask for asylum. And it does not matter how you got here. It does not matter whether you had legal permission to get here or not. The law is quite clear on that. Jerry Jaramillo, he's had legal permission to be here for most of his life. He's had legal permission to drive tanks on behalf of the U.S. Army. So this is a pretty diverse group of people.
And one of the things you talk about when they are detained, again, there's a civil detention and criminal detention, and oftentimes criminal detention goes along with civil detention because we've criminalized immigration in many cases. And you profile a couple of these facilities like the Cibola County Correctional Center, Willacy County Processing Facility. One of this is a Department of Prisons facility. The other is a ICE. But what is amazing in your book is you talk about the number of problems that these facilities, which have ramped up because of this huge population, and basically one facility was too bad for the Department of Prisons. It reopened under ICE. Another facility had too many violations for ICE. It opened back up under the Department of Prisons. Some of these have switched back and forth two or three times, and this goes to the money to be made in housing immigrants.
Yeah, the Cibola County facility in New Mexico, in a little town called Milan, New Mexico, small town, it's, I think, something like 3,000 people in the town. But that includes the people who are locked up inside this facility. And so the fact that there are about 300 people employed in this prison means that it has an enormous presence in the local economy, but is a really downtrodden community. I mean, this is a place where good paying jobs are really quite scarce. And so this 300 person prison smack in the middle of Milan, New Mexico, certainly represents an enormous part of the local economy. And so it wasn't a surprise that when the Bureau of Prisons, after years of experiencing poor conditions inside of the Cibola County facility, decided to end its relationship with the private prison corporation that ran it. And it made that announcement. And the local elected officials quickly jumped on top of this and said, no, we need to keep this place open. And we need to keep it open because otherwise we're going to lose all of these jobs. And so, sure enough, they did. They went out looking for another customer, and they found one in a different part of the federal government in ICE. So the Bureau of Prisons was using the facility to house folks who had been convicted of violating federal immigration law. That's primarily the crime of illegal entry or legal or the crime of illegal reentry, both of which turn on nothing more than coming to the United States without the government's permission. Well, after the BOP cut off the private prison corporation, ICE showed up on the scene and began using this facility to hold its detainees. These are people who are going through the immigration court process because they're suspected of having violating immigration law. So the same underlying activity leads to, on the one hand, people being confined because they've been convicted of a crime, or in the other moments being confined because the immigration courts are trying to figure out if they're going to be allowed to stay in the United States or not. But at the end of the day, they're being held in exactly the same place.
And of course, your takeaway is there's a better way of doing that, and that is not locking up nearly as many people as we do. We can certainly reduce that number significantly.
Yeah, and this is something that we've done in the past. In 1954, the Eisenhower administration and President Eisenhower's attorney general announced that the government was going to change its policy. He said that the government was going to close down its immigration prisons on the East Coast and on the West Coast, including, most importantly, the facility on Ellis Island, the place that Ellen Knopf and many others had been held. And I find that really quite important, because it's not that the Eisenhower administration decided, oh, no one's violating immigration law. On the contrary, the very last person who was released from the Ellis Island prison was a man named Arne Pedersen. When he was released, the New York Times reported that he was a Norwegian seaman who had overstayed his shore leave. What does that mean? Well, for immigration lawyers, what that means is he had come to the United States with the government's permission, and he had not left when he was supposed to. He had permission to come here temporarily to work, and he was supposed to leave at some point, and he didn't. This is a very common way of violating immigration law now, just as it was then. In the 1950s, threats to the United States were real. The Soviet Union was rising in power after the pounding that it had taken during World War II. The Cold War had started, and it wasn't just ideological fights. The Cold War in 1954 had already become real battles in Korea. And no one needed to tell President Eisenhower, the war hero turned Republican president, about the threats that the United States faced. And yet his administration had the courage to say, we don't need to lock up immigrants to keep the United States safe. We don't need to lock up immigrants to enforce immigration law. We can thrive by releasing them into communities. And that remained the policy of the United States for the next 25 years.
Denver University Law Professor Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez speaking with me back in February, just a few days before his originally scheduled B.C. Franklin Memorial Civil Rights Lecture, and before the pandemic, and before the current changes in U.S. immigration policy. The rescheduled University of Tulsa Law School lecture will take place this evening at 6 as a virtual lecture, and will be available afterwards online as well. To view the lecture, go to utulsa.edu and follow the links on the event page. Professor Garcia Hernandez's latest book is titled Migrating to Prison: America's Obsession with Locking Up Immigrants. It's published by the New Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.